All right, I'm here. I'm Scott. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. Did the news lady just say something about the Palestinians blackmailing the Israelis? Well, the thing of it is, it's the Israelis who are holding the Palestinians hostage. Not the other way around. And that's a simple fact. Like, you know, the sky is blue. Up is up and black ain't white. There is no Palestinian... God dang it. I'm going to turn the music back on if I can't start talking right. There is no Palestinian military occupation of Israel. They are the conquered. The Israelis are the conquerors. And they've been occupying the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem since 1967. But, oh no, if they threaten to file charges in the International Criminal Court for war crimes against the Israelis, well, that's blackmail. We can't let our slaves go unless they promise not to call the cops on us for enslaving them. Otherwise, there's just no basis for negotiation here. Who in the world takes Israel seriously at this point? Other than people who really don't understand that, yeah, no, really. The Israelis are stealing land from people. People who are real people and live on that land. Otherwise, everyone else is just shaking their head. Yeah. Israel won't give in to Palestinian blackmail. Ha. Ha ha. Ha ha. All right. Well, anyway. News. Today on the show, news. Also, interviews. I know that's how it usually is. News and interviews. And commercials. And a little bit of bumper music in and out of the commercials. Flint Leverett's going to be on the show. He's a former National Security Council staffer. Former State Department something or other. And former CIA analyst. And now he and his wife, Hillary Mann Leverett, they write critically about American foreign policy, especially concerning Iran. In this case, they have a new article out about Syria that I would like to hear them say out loud. In this case, it's going to be Flint. So he'll be on to talk about that. And then Michael Ratner will be on. He's the president emeritus or something at the Center for Constitutional Rights. And you might say, ain't them the Reds? And I might say, thank God for them Reds. When it comes down to it, conservatives hate the Bill of Rights. The only part of the Bill of Rights conservatives like is the Second Amendment. And even then, they don't really like the Second Amendment. They just like guns. But they don't believe in the principle that a man really has a right to a gun and that the government ought to be forbidden from interfering with that right. So they don't really believe in rights. So, you know, the closest thing you've got to a Center for Constitutional Rights on the right would be Judicial Watch. And they're only kind of good when Democrats are in power. Where the hell was Larry Klayman throughout the entire Bush years on every kind of torture and everything else? He started out good on the Cheney Energy Committee thing, but that was before 9/11. After that, yeah, he's a conservative. So, yeah, the CCR, they're the Reds. And good thing, too, because we need them to sue the government all day for the horrible things that they do. In this case, they've been representing, and I've been interviewing them about it since the beginning, they've been representing Old Man Alaki. I don't know his first name, so I call him Old Man Alaki. His son, Anwar Alaki, was the pro-Al-Qaeda preacher that Obama killed with a drone in Yemen, the American citizen, who was killed in a drone attack in Yemen that also killed a guy named Samir Khan, something like that, who was also an American citizen, and the publisher of their magazine, or editor of their magazine, Inspire. And then he's the grandfather of Awlaki's son, Abdulrahman, of Anwar's son, Abdulrahman, who Obama killed a couple of weeks later, along with his cousins and friends, while they were eating. And no one ever even pretended that he was a terrorist. Actually, you know what? That's not true. I think they did try to lie at first and say that he was a fighting-age male and was involved in terrorism. And then they had to back down when it was proven that he was only 16 years old. Should never let my lack of memory default to giving the government the benefit of the doubt at all. Because, nope, they did try to claim he was 21. And they did try to claim that he had some involvement in something. Yeah, right. Anyway. So the grandfather tried to sue the Obama administration to make them not kill his son, because they had already announced that they were going to kill him long before they did. And the courts gave him no standing to sue and dismissed his case. And then now he's sued again, now that they have killed his son and his grandson. He sued them again. And the court has ruled, forget you. The court ruled, forget me. I love that part. The court ruled, hey, I'm just a federal judge. It's not my role to tell the executive branch that they can't murder an American citizen. You know, if they feel like it. That was the ruling. Well, anyway, Michael Ratner's going to be on. I'll let him paraphrase it. He'll do a better job than me. I think it's going to sound a lot like that, unfortunately. Anyway, I'm going to ask him about a couple other things, too. The NSA, speaking of Larry Klayman, the Supreme Court has refused to hear Klayman's lawsuit against the NSA for bugging his phone. He's a Verizon customer, you know. And lower court said he was right. The Fourth Amendment should protect him. Now the Supreme Court has refused to hear. Oh, I think there was a... Then another court said, forget the injunction, whatever. You can do whatever you want. Oh, even that court said. They stayed their own injunction. And then the higher court disagreed with them and said the Fourth Amendment doesn't protect Larry Klayman from this. It's national security. And now the Supreme Court has refused to uphold it. Well, anyway, that's why I'm going to ask Michael Ratner, because he's the expert, not me. But yeah, I'm pretty sure that that's right. So anyway, that's where we are in America. And also, maybe look at those things and the national debt clock and maybe pack up your family and leave America before it's too late. And we live in a totalitarian fascist dictatorship where they don't even pretend that the law prevents them from doing anything that they want to you anymore. I mean, seriously, right now, if Obama announced, you know what? We don't need judges. Wouldn't the judges uphold that at this point? Wouldn't all the judges come together and say, well, hey, it's a matter of national security. He's the president. He was elected. He can do anything he wants to anyone he wants. Abolish the judiciary. And I'm for abolishing the judiciary, although I'd have them abolished last because they get the smallest army. You know, the Marshals Service. Get rid of the executive branch. I don't know, the legislative branch. They've got their sergeant at arms. That's all they've got. So, yeah, no, get rid of the judges. First, the executive, of course. Then the judges and their marshals. Then the sergeant at arms, disarm him, too. Abolish the national government that way. That's my theory. But the way they have it, the other way around, is that we ought to surrender all of our rights to them and unlimited power to them. And, you know, as Todd Pierce was explaining on the show the other day, we're already at least, you know, a giant part of the way toward completely abandoning the Constitution toward the so-called laws of war, the laws of the executive. And it's always high comedy to me. Oops. Ad's about to start. Got to make sure the volume's up on the music there. It's always high comedy to me when Obama says things like, yeah, no, we got to respect the Constitution, and yeah, we got to wind down the war and eventually repeal the AUMF. Well, in practice, he does nothing of the kind to try to do anything like that. And all he does is continue exercising the power that he says he doesn't want. Crying and shooting. Gonna have to wind down these wars. I mean, they say, I don't know, he's winding down Afghanistan. There's a new story today about all the equipment they're leaving behind. But then again, he's doing everything he can to keep 20,000 troops there. So what's that? It's just the end of the surge is all. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. Don't you want a bust of Murray Rothbard for your desk at work? A Ludwig von Mises for your bookshelf at home? A Harry Brown, a Ron Paul as a gift for a friend? Check out these awesome busts of your libertarian heroes at myheroesthink.com. They come in 6 or 9 inch sizes, and now in color, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf in my office, and I love it. Just click the banner ad in the right margin at scotthorton.org and enter promo code ScottHortonShow to save $5. That's myheroesthink.com. All right. I'm Scott. This is my show. I saw a thing earlier. What said right now is the libertarian moment. And I thought, well, good. It's certainly true that we have a confluence of things working for us right now as libertarians and promoting our superior values to the rest of society. And first of all, of course, it's Ron Paul. He's the guy that took Americans by the millions and said to them, yeah, libertarianism. It means you could be a capitalist against the drug war, against the foreign war. It means you don't have to be a right-winger to be pro-gun, and you don't have to be a left-winger to be pro-drug. You don't have to be a commie, especially to oppose the empire. That's why everybody loved Ron. Here's a lesson for his son. The reason everybody loved Ron Paul is because he said, don't worry about anybody calling you Michael Moore for being anti-war. You could be like me instead. And they went, oh, God, thank God. Ah, finally, I can be anti-war without being Michael Moore, the big, fat, commie, rat, hypocrite, zillionaire. That was a big relief to millions of Americans. And they've been coming this way by the millions. A lot of people, a lot of former right-wingers becoming less right-wing and much more libertarian. And I think a lot of liberals, too, have come to find out, progressives, people with principle on the left, have come to find out that when it comes to consistency on things like the Bill of Rights and peace, the libertarians are the only ones that you can really count on. I was making fun of Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch earlier because they were tweeting about how Snowden gave a speech where he revealed that the NSA spies on Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International all the time. After all they've done for the empire, supporting their humanitarian wars, like in Libya, trying to push us into Syria, Bosnia before that, and what have you. And anyway, you can't count on them, you know? I'm going to talk about Juan Cole here in a minute. You can't count on him. In fact, I'm going to talk about him right now because this has to do with Rand Paul. Is Rand Paul, as we talked about on the show yesterday, is on tape from back in the day saying obviously the reason Cheney wanted to do the war in Iraq so bad was because of Halliburton. And Juan Cole, who was bad on invading Iraq, was bad on Iran and war with Iran and regime change in Iran even in 2009 during the Green Revolution, of course supported the war in Libya in 2011, and who I just can't take seriously anymore. I mean, come on, man. I should have completely given up on him after supporting some kind of intervention in the Green Revolution in 09. What are you, Bill Kristol? And then, but boy, calling for war and regime change in Libya, that was just too far for me. But anyway, he's published a blog entry today, which is ridiculous. Another example of how stupid he is. He thinks you have to be a communist to think that a corporation might use power and influence to get government to do things for them. Juan Cole, man, what in the world is the matter with you? Anyway, so he's really confused. Why would Rand Paul, a right-wing libertarian, think that a corporation would try to make the government do something for their own benefit? That makes no sense. That's like something that a liberal would say, Juan Cole says. Yeah, okay, dude. You thunk real good that time. Except that all of libertarianism considers conservatism and liberalism to ultimately be at least soft fascism. Your quasi-free market, your mixed economy, is all political favors. Fascism, even in Mussolini's time in Italy, the private companies wanted themselves to be under the dictates of the fascist state because they help run the fascist state and its dictates. And so, you know, anyway, don't try to teach a thing to Juan Cole, Scott. Just move on. Anyway, so Juan Cole's an idiot, but he does point out, because he's a commie, he can think that a corporation might, you know, lobby to have policies that would favor them. Very unique point of view on the left, I know. He reproduces part of his book where he talks about Dick Cheney's frustration as head of Halliburton that the pro-Israel policy of dual containment of Iraq and Iran and all the sanctions against Iraq and Iran were limiting those markets and preventing Halliburton from doing the business. And, you know, their thing is the physical part of it, digging the wells, pumping the oil out of the ground, building the pipelines, this kind of thing. They're a construction business more than an oil company, you know? And so he wanted the government contracts from the army intervention, sure, but he really wanted to do a lot of business with Iraq and Iran. I guess I don't really know the whole story of this, not as well as Juan Cole tells it, but you've heard me mention about how Dick Cheney, I remember this, when Dick Cheney in 98 went to Australia and gave a speech denouncing Bill Clinton for the sanctions against Iran specifically and saying the Iranians are people too, we can do business with them, and the revolution and the hostages was a long time ago, and I'm Dick Cheney, the former SecDef Republican, after all, and so if I say it's okay, as a Nixon goes to China kind of thing. And the way Juan Cole puts it is that the oil lobby and the Dick Cheney oil construction firm lobby were up against the Israel lobby on sanctions on Iraq and Iran, and they couldn't win. And so Dick Cheney basically made the compromise that, fine, we'll just have a war. Then we can lift the sanctions after we get our regime change. And then they can make their money that way. And, of course, a big part of it, as we talked about with Todd Pierce on the KPFK show on Sunday, too, is the ideology of American empire and the theory that after the end of the Cold War, America needs to completely conquer the planet Earth militarily and threaten any power or even a possible alliance of powers from even considering matching American military might ever. And so in order to do that, we need lily pad bases everywhere, and we need compromised dictators and pretended democracies and whatever you want to call them all over the place. We need to eventually regime change Russia, and or as Robert Gates who says in his memoir that Dick Cheney wanted to tear Russia itself apart, not just the USSR and their entire massive Soviet empire in Eastern Europe and in Central Asia, but to dismember Russia itself. And, you know, and then, you know, we're frenemies with the Chinese, but we can still contain them and threaten them from ever even trying to really build up a military, anything more than the slightest deterrent to us anyway, but certainly prevent them from trying to project power. This is the theory. And so that's why you see in the 1990s, you know, all these neocons and the Cheneyites got along just fine. And Cheney was, you know, one of the original signers, I believe, wasn't he? of the Project for New American Century's letters to Bill Clinton. I know Jeb Bush was on there too, pushing for regime change in Iraq. Anyway, if Rand Paul needs a talking point, you ought to go look at Juan Cole's blog today, because he does have a pretty good write-up. I think maybe the best write-up that I know of, other than just a finger-pointing accusation about Dick Cheney's motivation in switching from trying to make peace with Iraq and Iran to trying to go ahead and get a regime change because the Israelis were not going, and their partisans in the U.S. were not going to ever let the sanctions be lifted and the dual containment be lifted until regime change could be won. So he basically gave up on trying to pester Bill Clinton into being more dovish and went the other way. But anyway, so he could be the libertarian's chance. And, you know, libertarians, not many, but, well, I don't know what the numbers are. Some libertarians mistake Rand for Ron, and they think he's good enough or he's just like him. And if he votes wrong and says the wrong thing, sometimes it's just because he has to. Kind of like people believed about Obama, liberals believed about Obama in 08. They're like, oh, I know he sounds like Hillary Clinton, only talks softer, but actually he really believes exactly the same thing as me. Just give him a chance, you know, that kind of crap. And I think that libertarians give Rand Paul probably way too much slack for as bad as he's been on some things. But I would also say that the establishment, they think he's his father, too. They don't see the discrepancy. And when he tries to say, look, man, I'm not a libertarian. I'm a realist. And I'm a moderate. I'm a Reaganite. And these kinds of things, they don't believe him. He's still Ron Paul to them. And I think he thinks, just like the Libertarian Party thinks, and you know what? I can't do the counterfactual. He did win a race for the Senate, after all. I think he might have been able to win anyway. Maybe not in that time, but if he's ever going to be the president, he would have to have a real consensus behind him. He would have to have enough Democrats willing to cross the aisle and you know, be a huge, really a substantial percentage of swing voters for him to overcome all the Republicans who stay home, all the warmongers who stayed home, assuming he ever got the nomination. And it's the same mistake I think the Libertarian Party makes. They run Republican light. Well, this guy is kind of a fiscal conservative. Let's run him as a libertarian. Okay, but why would any Republican voter vote for the Republican who's guaranteed to lose when they can vote for the Republican who's guaranteed to win? And how are you teaching anybody libertarianism if that would at least be the side effect of nominating a libertarian, would at least he'd get to get the word out about some things. But if he's just a fiscal conservative, then what good does it do you anyway? You know, you don't win the office, you compromise, you don't win the office, but you also don't preach a good message either. So the whole thing is just a wash, as the Libertarian Party has been forever. And they don't seem to realize, look at how good they had it during Harry Brown. Harry Brown was hardcore on principle, hardcore always, and he did great as far as getting the message across. And I don't know if he pulled that many votes, but it's the Libertarian Party after all. But he's no warmed over Republican. He stood by principle, and I think for Rand, they're all against him anyway. He might as well stand up and fight about it, you know? Especially while the conservatives are pretending to be good while the Democrats are in the White House. Because, you know, when Jeb comes, if he's the one who wins, then all the conservatives are going to forget they ever cared about liberty or ever heard that word before at all. Mark my words, I've seen it before over and over again. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the War State, available at ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I need to cue up this piece here. It's Flint Leverett and his wife, Hillary Mann Leverett, authors of Going to Tehran. America Must Accept the Islamic Republic of Iran. And they're at worldfinancialreview.com with this one. Can the West get out of its self-made cul-de-sac in Syria? Welcome back to the show, Flint. How are you doing?
I'm just great, Scott. Good to be with you again.
Good times. Yeah, very happy to have you back on the show. And it's an excellent piece that you have here with Hillary.
Thank you.
I guess, you know what, it's pretty rich in background. So why don't you go ahead and fill us in on America, you know, before we get to, you know, the current choices to be made, you guys put it, the background of how we've gotten to where we are now in terms of American involvement in the so-called, at least, civil war in Syria over the last 3 years.
Yeah, well, I think it really goes back to the very, you know, earliest days in March and April of 2011 when protests broke out in some parts of Syria. This was right after the Arab Awakening had forced out the longtime pro-Western authoritarian president of Tunisia, and even more significantly, from an American perspective, it had forced the longtime authoritarian president of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, a critical partner for, let's say, the worst aspects of American foreign policy in the Middle East. A popular uprising had forced Mubarak from office. And the Obama administration was, you know, really, really worried about a collapse of the U.S. position in the Middle East. And so they were looking around for somewhere where they could appear to be on the right side of history, somewhere where they could show that it wasn't just authoritarians who were willing to subordinate their country's foreign policies to American preferences who could get challenged by popular uprisings. They wanted to show you could bring down a government that actually had a track record of foreign policy independence. The other thing they were looking to do, they were really worried that Iran was going to benefit regionally from the spread of popular governments in the Arab world. And they were looking for a place where regime change would do harm to Iran's regional position. And Syria seemed to fit the bill on both counts. And so from early on, the administration started encouraging and supporting the opposition, coordinating with allies, whether European allies, the Saudis, the Turks, the Qataris, to fund and equip armed oppositionists in Syria. A big percentage of whom, it turns out, aren't even Syrian, but have been brought in from outside of Syria. And very early on, the president declared Bashar al-Assad must go, even though there was no real plan to make him go. And the reality then, as now, Assad has the support of a significant majority of Syria's population. And I think this was a really tragic course for the United States to take for a couple of reasons. One, just in terms of the way Syrian politics has evolved, you know, I think there were, at the beginning of this, there were some, you know, legitimate local preferences, people who were clearly alienated from their government, had what they thought were grievances against their government, and who were trying to bring those out. And this, I think, could have been dealt with potentially through a kind of, you know, process of negotiation between the Assad government and disaffected parts of Syrian society. But instead, with this infusion of outside money, outside weapons, encouragement from outside powers, it turned pretty quickly into, as you said in your setup, turned into a very bloody civil war that, you know, 3 years on has killed probably around 150,000 people. The other reason it's really sad is because it has once again gotten the United States, you know, trapped in this, and as we called it, this cul-de-sac of its own making, that the United States still can't get it straight, that it really doesn't do very well at trying to dictate the political future of Middle Eastern countries. It doesn't do it very well when it invades and occupies those countries, like in Iraq, and it doesn't do very well when it tries to dictate the future by using a kind of externally supported opposition. We did this in Afghanistan, got the Taliban and al-Qaeda as a result. We did it in Libya. We got a dead American ambassador and an incubating al-Qaeda threat in North Africa as a result. And now we're doing it again in Syria, and Syria has become, you know, the leading trading ground for the next generation of al-Qaeda.
Yeah, but these are just the birth pangs of a new Middle East, Flynn. I mean, it's an extended labor, maybe, but there's a democratic future right now. Okay, I'm sorry. Well, so there's a lot to talk about. I guess, first of all, when it comes to the initial conflict, it seems like, and I'm not the master of this history, I guess I didn't know good sources, you know, in-depth sources to cover, you know, right at the beginning there to read about what exactly was happening there. But I guess at least my impression is that Assad really cracked down on what were mostly peaceful protests, kind of way out of line, and really hardened his opposition and in other ways made mistakes where he could have been a lot more gracious in the midst of the Arab Spring.
I think that's absolutely right. I think the Assad government did make some serious mistakes early on. But I think that the problem was made much, much worse by, from early on, having externally provided weapons, money, foreign fighters, jihadis, all coming into Syria to, you know, escalate the violence on the other side. I think that just, you know, from very early on, it got turned into a very militarized conflict rather than what should have been a political process.
Right. Yeah, well, especially when, I mean, as Patrick Coburn has been saying on this show all along and in his writing, of course, all along, it's the case that he never was losing. Assad never was losing. These guys never could win. And so what the Americans have done,
that's right,
like the Israelis talked about, just, you know, let the two sides wear each other out and all of that kind of thing. It, you know, that's, that kind of policy has led to I don't know how many refugees, and they say a couple of 100,000 people killed on either side. And now maybe the Sunni rebel types would have really been crushed severely if Assad, you know, if the outside powers had not been backing them. Maybe he would have really, you know, beaten them quicker. And that might have been a lot worse for them, but it seems like it would have saved the massive humanitarian crisis that exists on all sides in a war that no side can win now, you know?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, Hillary and I have been saying for 3 years since this started that Assad wasn't going to fall. He was not going to be overthrown, at least not by Syrians. That if you look at where his government has substantial bases of support in Syrian society, you know, it pretty clearly adds up to, you know, over half of the society. And from what information we've been able to gather, whether through, you know, polls, internet surveys, participation rates in a couple of elections that have been held in Syria since the conflict started, you know, there is a fair empirical case to make that Assad still at this point has a majority support in Syria. In fact, as the jihadis have come to be kind of the dominant force within the opposition on the ground in Syria, there is evidence that popular support for the opposition has really shrunk. NATO did a study last year in which they concluded that 70% of the population is actually supporting Assad over any plausible alternative. Only 10% supported the opposition at that point, and 20% were basically neutral.
All right, now let me ask you, how could that be when this guy is a fascist totalitarian monster with a secret police force? He tortures people. We know he tortures people because he tortures them for the Americans sometimes.
Yes, he has apparently done that. But, you know, if you look at it in a Syrian context, Syria is this very complicated, very divided, multi-ethnic, multi-sectarian society. And part of what the Assad government represents, and it is, you know, whatever else you may say about it, it isn't a validly secular government. And so for religious minorities in Syria, for non-Sunni Muslims, who are probably, you know, 15% of the population, for Christians, who are another, you know, 10 to 15% of the population, for Sunnis who don't want to live in an al-Qaeda state, you know, you put those communities together and they support the Assad government because it is the Assad government which not just under Bashar, but for 30 years under Bashar's father, Hafez al-Assad, has protected them from what they would see as government by jihadi crazies. And so, you know, those communities really support the Assad government.
All right. Now, we only have a minute left before this break, but I guess we can start on this line of questioning about whether the border between Syria and Iraq, which was drawn after the First World War by the British and the mm-hmm. French, whether it exists anymore, whether the state of Syria will exist anymore. I wonder, honestly, it's funny. It reminds me of Bush's ridiculous claim about the Islamo-fascist caliphate in the heart of the Middle East. It seems like he's just created it with the Sunni revolt in the Anbar provinces and into Syria now with ISIS and al-Nusra.
That's right. You definitely have. And, you know, this was happening during our occupation of Iraq. One of the ways that Sunni jihadis were getting into Iraq was through Syria. And now it's going the other way.
All right. Now, I'm sorry. We got to stop there, Flint, because we got to take this break. Of course, the Syria thing has re-energized the whole rebellion in Iraq and led to even more violence. I'm sorry. I shouldn't interrupt you. But now we got to go. We'll take this short break, and we'll be right back with Flint Leverett. He teaches foreign policy at Penn State and wrote the book Going to Tehran. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., natsummit.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Flint Leverett. Like I was saying, he teaches foreign policy at Penn State. He co-authored the book Going to Tehran with his wife, Hillary Mann Leverett. He's a former CIA analyst, former National Security Council, and former State Department guy, and a real expert on all this stuff. And now, I'm sorry, because I asked you a big question right before the commercial break, but that's just how it goes around here, Flint. You were saying about various jihads, or the one big jihad maybe, in the Sunni areas of Iraq and in Syria.
Yeah, I mean, there's a fairly porous border between Iraq and Syria, and during the U.S. occupation of Iraq, Sunni militants were making their way into Iraq in no small part through Syria, and now the flow is in many ways reversed. You have jihadis who fought in Iraq coming into Syria. The U.S. intelligence community estimates that you could have, you know, between 25 and 30% of the opposition fighters, those who are, you know, actively fighting against the opposition government, the Assad government, are not actually Syrian. They're from outside Syria. And they are actually the most effective, the most experienced, the most lethal fighters in the opposition. You know, most of the rest of those guys don't seem to be able to fight their way out of a paper bag. But these jihadis, and they've been, you know, battle-hardened. They know what they're doing. But a lot of them come in from outside.
Well, and the thing of it is this, too. I mean, you mentioned Afghanistan before and the holy jihad of the 1980s and all of that. And I guess the lesson from that, right, was that, yeah, but then what are you going to do with these guys because you can't control them? And so now here we are, we're dealing with that exact same lesson again from the war in Iraq. What are you going to do with the fighters? Not that Bush was fighting for them the whole time. He was fighting for the Iranian side the whole time in that one. But he gave them a giant lawless territory to train in and become Al-Qaeda in Iraq in and all that, the Islamic State.
And then
Iraq.
The U.S. military provided them with very high-quality live ammunition training. Yeah,
it left all of Saddam Hussein's depots wide open for the looting and all the rest of it. Yeah, and so we saw that giant war where they, you know, they might as well have been backing him for all the good that it did Al-Qaeda during the Iraq war years. And then now with the Americans actually fighting directly on the side of the jihadis in Libya and in Syria, it brings up the obvious question. Well, who the hell's going to call these guys to Geneva for the ceasefire? How do you get a bunch of suicide bombers to cooperate ever again? Will there ever be anything like an Arab state in that part of Iraq and Syria ever again? You know, not that I'm the biggest champion of states, but if it's just lawless warring chaos from now on, that's not much of an improvement.
No, and I think it is going to be an ongoing security problem in that part of the region, in Iraq, in Syria, for years to come. And you're right, it is in many respects a direct result of U.S. policy. I mean, you don't even have to, you know, go back to the Bush administration. What the Obama administration did in Libya, where we didn't even really, as Obama kept telling us, we didn't even really put boots on the ground, but we, you know, we provided the Air Force basically for the anti-Qaddafi opposition, provided them or coordinated with our allies to provide them with all kinds of weapons. And, you know, it's jihadi militants that either we supplied or one of our allies supplied that murdered the U.S. ambassador in Libya and three other officials. Americans. I mean, this is how, you know, how utterly turned on its head this approach is.
Yeah. Well, you know, Eric Margolyes was on the show, and he, I think, about 55% seriously said, we ought to be allies with Assad right now. That's it. Just the same way as we should have let Saddam back in from the cold after 9/11 and said, look, listen, you fulfill your prime responsibility, which is keeping Al-Qaeda down and keeping them, you know, east of Iran somewhere, and we'll let you live, that kind of thing. They could be doing, and I'm a libertarian, I'm not for any of this, but I'm just saying Margolyes isn't, so he can make that kind of an argument that, you know what, our interest is in fighting these Al-Qaeda guys, and that means not overthrowing Assad, that means backing him.
That's right. I mean, if you want to look at things in those terms, if what you're looking for is a strong secular government that has a long track record of you know, forceful and effective opposition to Sunni Islamist radicalism, you know, the Assad government is your ticket.
Well, now, so, okay, I'm sorry, because it's too much, and it's my fault, too. I frame this whole discussion in terms of the idiocy of this Obama Clinton, Petraeus, Panetta policy, whatever it is, whoever I'll carry to, that we've been talking about here. And it is idiotic on the face of it, but that's only from an American citizen national interest point of view, not a U.S. government point of view, which has an entirely different set of interests over there. And they consider weakening Iran important enough that they don't care if they're backing al-Qaeda against them. Right?
I was really struck. You're absolutely right. And, I think this is very much the mindset that if you can weaken Iran, it really doesn't matter, you know, what other, you know, supposedly unintended consequences you create. I have to give John McCain credit for one thing. A year or so ago, he went to Syria. He went into Syria for about an hour and a half and met with some oppositionists. And at least some journalists were enterprising enough to do a little bit of research and figure out that some of the oppositionists that Senator McCain met with while he was doing his, you know, drive-by run in Syria were people who at least had been involved in the kidnapping of Shia religious pilgrims in Syria, may have been involved in worse stuff than that. And so when he came back and went on all of the talking head shows to talk about how great the opposition was in Syria, how the United States needed to be doing more to support them and no-fly zones and all of this. And somebody, actually, one host, actually had the wherewithal to ask him. But, you know, Senator, some of these guys you met with were turned out to be not very good guys. And if we give weapons to them, you know, aren't some of those weapons going to end up in the hands of some pretty bad guys? And McCain's answer, I swear to you, you can look at the tape. His answer was, he didn't even try and defend it. He just said, at least they won't be working for Iran. And so McCain, and I think the Obama administration is more or less with him, if they think it would hurt Iran, they would rather give weapons to al-Qaeda, give al-Qaeda a new lease on life, than actually come up with some serious diplomatic approach to Iran. That's how far gone it is.
So, in other words, I mean, because at the same time, they're pursuing this nuclear deal, which, of course, is the single greatest outstanding, parentheses, fake issue between America and Iran. They are working hard on settling that, are they not? And so is this supposed to be just another stick to try to get the Iranians to make this pseudo-peace deal here? I mean, because this is a pretty hard stick to be using.
We don't know yet how serious the Obama administration really is. If when you actually get down to the nitty-gritty of negotiating the text of a final deal, if the Obama administration is basically not going to be prepared to accept both the reality and kind of the principle of Iran doing safeguarded enrichment and basically what you can get from Iran is greater transparency on their nuclear activities, but they're not going to agree to let the United States kind of micromanage their nuclear program and, you know, cut two-thirds of it out. If the administration doesn't, you know, get serious about that, it's not really serious about negotiating a deal. And the fact that they're still pursuing these policies in Syria, you know, suggests that they aren't all that committed to trying to realign relations with Iran. You know, they'll do it if Iran basically is willing to surrender. Then they would be prepared to realign relations. But if realigning relations is going to mean actually accepting the Islamic Republic as a legitimate order representing legitimate national interests, I don't think it's clear yet that the Obama administration's up for that.
All right. Now, one more thing here, and I'm sorry because we're so short on time, but can you give us a thumbs up or thumbs down on Seymour Hersh's new piece about the sarin attack last August?
You know, I think Cy Hersh has, over the course of his very, very long and distinguished career, he has nailed some really important stories going all the way back to the My Lai massacre during the Vietnam War. You know, he's one of the central figures in breaking the Abu Ghraib story during the Iraq War. And this latest piece he has in the London Review of Books is, I think, a really very strongly reported and very important piece, because what it says is that, you know, last year when Obama was making noises about attacking Syria because the Syrian government had supposedly used chemical weapons against its own people, that in fact the intelligence case wasn't there, and that more and more evidence came in that it was in fact opposition fighters with help from Turkey that had concocted this kind of homemade sarin precisely to get Obama to take a more active U.S. military role in the conflict. I think it's a very strongly reported piece.
Mm-hmm. And now, it was already reported. I mean, even at the time, it was obvious, right, that they had the government report instead of a CIA report. There was a problem over there at CIA, and Philip Giraldi reported in the American Conservative magazine that some of them were actually going to fire in as a group, kind of en masse. They were going to resign. What did I just say? They were going to resign and protest over this.
Yeah.
And so we knew about that, that they kind of weren't buying it. But I wonder whether you know anybody in CIA or the circles that you run with, State Department people, former friends, whoever. Is that what they think, that the Turks did this? Can you verify, even with hearsay, that this comes from anywhere other than Hirsch by any chance? I'm not saying you've written about it before.
I have heard what I would call informed speculation about that. I'm not privy to classified information anymore. And but I think you're right. I think there has been strong suspicion within the U.S. intelligence community about the claim that various attacks in Syria last year, that Syrian military forces were using, were the ones using sarin. The Russians investigated this. The UN investigated this. Some of the UN inspectors actually came out in public and said they thought it was the opposition that was doing this. But no one here wanted to hear that, and so that really didn't get followed up. But I think there's tons of room for, questioning the case that Obama made last summer.
All right, great. Well, thanks very much for your time, Flynn. It's always great to talk to you.
Thank you, Scott. Always good to talk with you. Thanks again.
All right, everybody. That is Flint Leverett, former CIA, State Department, National Security Council. He and his wife, Hillary Mann Leverett, are the authors of the book Going to Tehran, which is really great. And that's also the name of their blog, Going to Tehran, where they write many great things. This piece, it may well be there. I didn't get a chance to look. But this piece is at worldfinancialreview.com, worldfinancialreview.com. Can the West get out of its self-made cul-de-sac with Syria? And we'll be right back in just a second. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all. So I'm back. I got the bad news. Went a little overtime with Flint there, but yeah, we got to hear some important stuff, right? Okay, good. How about this one? FBI. Man plotted to fly drone-like toy planes with bombs into school. Oh, won't someone think of the children? What are we going to do? I'll tell you what, this is a lie. You're smarter than this, right? You've seen this 1,000 times, just like me, right? And you know what to do. You just scan through the article till you find the word informant. Oh, there it is. Undercover agent. That's in the thesaurus for informant. The undercover agent just so happened to be in a position to secretly record this lone wolf terrorist and his plot to use toy remote control planes to bomb a school. Aren't you terrified? Now, the government is doing everything they can to create new terrorists to want to kill you around the world all the time. But the problem is they just can't get here because the, at the same time, the Border Patrol and the customs guys are trying to keep them out. And the security agencies at the airports at the in the other countries, why, they don't really let these guys get on planes to America in the first place. And so there just ain't no real Al-Qaeda in America. So the FBI's got to make them up. And they've done this. I can factually just plainly assert to you, this is not an exaggeration. This is not some figure of speech. They have framed at least 50 people in these bogus terrorism cases. I wish I could rattle them all off the top of my head, but of course the New Jersey pizza plot was one. The plot to bomb all the fuel tanks at the New York Kennedy Airport was another. And then, let's see, in Detroit, I think that was just a guy who was facing life in prison, made up a bunch of lies. I don't know if he ever successfully got those guys to do anything. Then there was a guy they killed in his warehouse, also in Detroit, who had been in trap, but hadn't even really fallen for the bait, but they murdered him anyway. Big SWAT raid on the warehouse, remember that one? And then in Lodi, California, poor Hamid Hyatt. I finally memorized the poor kid's name, so I don't have to say the poor kid in Lodi, California only. He's a person, his name's Hamid Hyatt, he's just some kid. And what happened was the FBI rat, who they paid hundreds of thousands of dollars, which I don't know about you, but it would take me many years to make hundreds of thousands of dollars. They paid this guy hundreds of thousands of dollars to infiltrate a family. He infiltrated a father and son, and I guess the mother was dead or was long gone somewhere. It was a father and son. He called the father, father. And he treated the son like a younger brother. And he became their bestest friend in the whole world and came over every night for dinner and everything for like a year. All just to try to entrap this completely innocent, apolitical kid into saying, yeah, yeah, fine, I love Osama then. And it ended up, it got so crazy, they sent him to Pakistan. He went home to Pakistan to visit his grandfather. And they tried to turn that into a whole plot of conspiring with Al-Qaeda to blow up all this stuff. And the FBI just made it all up. Same thing happened in Miami, Florida, where they just took those losers from Liberty City and said, we'll give you hundreds of thousands of dollars if you'll just say, oh yeah, you're part of Al-Qaeda's army. And of course, these idiots, they thought they were the players, and they were getting away with pimping this Al-Qaeda idiot for all this money. But of course, they were the idiots, and the Al-Qaeda idiot was an FBI informant, simply entrapping them into pretending that they were going along with this crap. And it happens over and over. Oh, and then there was the last one of remote control planes, right? He was going to attack. There was a guy who was going to attack the Pentagon with remote control planes. Oh, and I skipped one of the very first ones was the retarded kid at the bookstore in Brooklyn who they entrapped for the plot to destroy the Brooklyn Bridge. Or no, no, no. This one was to blow up a subway station. Anyway, there's a ton of them. There's 50 of them. And Trevor Aronson, he did the work. I wanted to write this book. I didn't do it. Trevor Aronson wrote the book. It's called The Terror Factory. And it's about how the FBI are liars. And so, you know, there's real reason to question when something happens like attack in Boston. Of first of all, was the FBI too busy chasing their tail, framing up some nobody to actually protect people who are victims of a guy who was recruited overseas into waging an attack like this on our soil? Or was he an FBI informant? And then did he go rogue, or did they actually give him explosives? Or what is the deal? Did they have a sting, but it got called off? You don't have to be any kind of kook to think that you're not being told the whole story, especially when we see how good the FBI is at getting some idiot to believe he's working with Al-Qaeda. Give him a little bit of money. Oh, man, I left out the poor guy with the pizza store. There's so many of them, man. I'm telling you, if you read Trevor Aronson's book, or just listen to my interview on him, but read Trevor Aronson's book, and it's just a damn travesty what they do to people, man. It's just ridiculous. And you know why? It's because there ain't no Al-Qaeda. Last time there were Al-Qaeda here, there were a couple of dozen of them, and they got away with it. And the FBI's been framing up idiots and losers and nobodies ever since. The only exceptions would be Moussaoui, who, if they had done their job on him, they could have stopped the attack in the first place. He was already here. And then there was Richard Reed, the shoe bomber. And then there was, which he's prosecuted by the British, not the Americans anyway. And then there's Zazi from Denver, had a plot to bomb something in New York. And then there was Faisal Shahzad, the kid that was recruited by the Pakistani Taliban who tried to blow up Times Square. And there was Abdullah Muttalib, who was put on the plane by somebody in Yemen, presumably Al-Qaeda in Yemen, who somehow was able to change planes without a passport in the Netherlands and tried to blow up and failed, thank goodness, but tried to blow up a plane over Detroit. And so anyway, those are the exceptions. And there's been more than 50. And those are actually just real terrorists, not necessarily real Al-Qaeda guys, you know, but maybe. But the rest, every time they're parading one of these guys across your screen and pretending to be your hero and protect you from terrorism, they're lying. Who was going to give this kid a remote control plane? Oh, I guess they say he was 27. Still, who gave him the remote control plane? Who gave him the idea? Who became his best friend in the world before his politics ever became this radical? Give me a break. I'm sorry for going on so long about this, but in case you ain't aware, it's really important, I think. It's sort of, it's really one of the least covered defining attributes of our era, honestly, here in this early 21st century, where, oh yeah, the FBI's fake terrorism cases? Jeez, don't get me started. You see what happens when you get me started. That's kind of a big deal. I mean, of course, we have the whole, the torture secret black site prisons in Poland and Romania and in Thailand and Morocco and Guantanamo Bay, Gulag, and communist Cuba to this day and all of this. But the domestic prosecutions, and keep this in mind too, when they say, oh, it's too dangerous to bring these guys from their military prisons to federal court and prosecute them. Man, the federal government can convict somebody of terrorism by showing up and breathing heavy. They don't have to fight to win a terrorism conviction in federal court at all, ever. They win always, no matter how much they're lying. If it's somebody who's actually done something, they'll nail them to the wall. Are you kidding me? Nobody gets away with it. The last guy who got away with it was the guy that killed Rabbi Kahane back in 1989. And again, if they had done their job that time, they would have unraveled the blind sheikh's proto-Al-Qaeda cell. Zawahiri's bosom buddy, right? Islamic Jihad in New York. They would have unraveled that whole thing before the World Trade Center ever got bombed the first time, and before any of the plotting against the tunnels or anything else. Anyway, damn FBI. Next time somebody dies in a massive attack in this country and they say Al-Qaeda did it, which I think is plausible now because they have created literally at least 10,000, probably more, Al-Qaeda, Bin Ladenite type jihadis across the Middle East, at some point, law of averages, some of them are going to be able to get in here at some point. Somebody seeking revenge is going to, and then it's not hard to imagine how someone could commit a real, you know, massive Al-Qaeda style attack on Americans, and then we'll wonder, well, where was the FBI? And then the answer will be, oh, well, they were busy entrapping some retarded kid they found at the bookstore. Here, kid, I'll give you $50,000. Now tell the video camera that you love Osama. It'll be a one-day trial. All right. I got more complaining and a great interview with Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Rights coming up later on the show. So hang around. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right. I'm me. It's my show. Here in just a few, we'll have Michael Ratner on to talk about the lawless federal police state tyranny. Man, that whole last segment I spent on entrapment cases, and I was going to run down a list of so much news to cover, so I'm going to try again on that. Remember Miriam Carey? She's the lady that tried to ram the White House gates and then was chased by the cops and then shot to death, the young girl in the car at the time. And of course the cops, first of all, the Congress broke out into applause. Not that they knew exactly what happened, but on the assumption that anyone killed by the police must have really had it coming. Boy, they probably were afraid. Jeez, are you telling me I almost died just now? The Congress cheered. Even the AP story today says that she tried to ram the gates of the White House. When, actually, if I remember it right, I don't have it completely, memorize every footnote like I should on a case like this, but I seem to remember that she hit it. But there was a discrepancy, actually, as to whether she had already been screamed at by somebody screaming at her for being in the wrong place. She'd made a wrong turn. And then she kind of panicked because some pig was screaming at her. And I think some reports were, eyewitness reports where they were hitting her car, like banging on it. And so she freaked out and bumped into the little orange and white barricade there, something like that. They tried to turn that into, she was on her way ramming the White House. And of course, she was crazy. She was some crazy woman who believed crazy things. They went on and on about that for days. Did you get this? She thought Barack Obama was videotaping her life like the Truman Show and things. Yeah, well, sometimes people have some psychoses and things like that. And so apparently, maybe she was trying to go to the White House to confront Obama about it. Wouldn't that have been a stupid thing to do? But that doesn't mean that does not even imply that she was trying to ram the barricades to assault the president or anything like that, the way that they characterized it. And then her panic and making a 3-point and turning around and get the hell out of there is perfectly explainable by the screaming pigs in her face. Here's a woman who's at least half crazy, however you define that, who's panicking. And these meathead cops, these DC cops, they can't think for a minute that, hey man, maybe this is some really freaked out, confused housewife in a stressful situation. All they can think is this is the episode of their primetime hero show. This is their chance to shoot somebody, to be a big hero. So they chase her all around. They finally corner her, and then, I'm not trying to take the responsibility away from them, but at this point, it's pretty much just automatic, right? I'm still characterizing these cops as what kind of people they are. At this point, they're so excited that by the time they've got her stopped and they have a clean shot at her, that's it. They kill her. They just killed her. They shot her 5 times in the back. Oh, they waited 6 months to release the autopsy for some reason. They waited for you to forget, to not care, to not be interested in this story anymore. And then it turns out that these cops, and, they fired at least 7 times, so there's 2 rounds that missed. And that's an at least from the video. They shot her, an unarmed woman, in a car that was stopped far at that point, I believe at a concrete barrier, and another, you know, cornered between cop cars and a concrete barrier, and out of her car and far from the White House or any terrorist danger to the president. And what are these guys thinking? It must be Hezbollah or what? Or are they thinking at all? Or are they thinking, now's my chance that I get to kill somebody? I've been waiting all this time. Now I get to kill somebody, and there's no way I'll get in trouble for this one after what she's done. And then they executed her. They shot her 5 times, including once in the back of the head. Their little baby a yard away, if that, in the back seat. Oh, and then, but forget about it. We're heroes, and that's all you need to know. That's all anybody needs to know. That was their statement at the time, because some reporters said, hey, so it turned out it was just some crazy housewife, huh? And they were like, what? Are you kidding me? Are you calling into question the bravery of the park police or whatever? These guys pump steroids all day just for situations like this. We'll be damned if we'll have you impugn the integrity of our effective counter-terror forces. Oh, it was just some unarmed lady in her sedan who never meant harm to anyone, who was confused and panicked and being chased by crazy steroid-pumping meatheads, who then murdered her. Now, in all the coverage of this, what I've got so far, I got one site that seemed pretty critical, and I got one from the Huffington Post. Nobody calls this murder. How isn't this murder? You know how it isn't murder? Because they're cops. And they can kill who they feel like. By any other definition, they murdered this lady. You do not have the right to shoot someone in public in the back because they're getting out of their car, getting back into their car. By no threshold of immediacy or proportionality could that possibly be considered anything but a murder if anyone but a cop did it. It's murder. The cops murdered the lady. But hey, whatever. I mean, what do you think is going to happen? TV is going to take the side of the people, of any citizen, any private person in America against the state and its armed executioners on the street? Maybe in exceptional circumstances. But for the most part, the beginning of every newscast, even the weather, is that it's totally legitimate that these guys are our government. Right? Now sports. Don't worry, governments run stuff for you. There you go. They got it for you. See, I was going to go on fast. They murdered that lady. They murdered her. She wasn't trying to kill the president. She wasn't anywhere near the president. She wasn't trying to ram her way into the White House or any of their hyperbole. And she wasn't a threat to anyone at the time that they took her life. Simple as that. Up is up, down is down, and that's a fact. Simple as that. Oh, but she might have gotten in her car and driven away. Well, then you guys can chase her some more. You can try to block her in, do your pit maneuver, tough guy. But no, you can't just shoot her in the head. Oh, you can. I mean, you may not, says me, which is worth nothing. But yes, in fact, you may. You sure as hell can. Alright, and then, let me see here. Let's skip that. Oh, I read a hilarious attack on Seymour Hersh's piece. And by the way, I don't claim to have individually evaluated everybody's supposed forensic conclusions on which bombs came from which direction and all this kind of stuff. I have my confirmation biases, but I'm not saying I'm 100% on every single thing here. But I read the most hilarious attack on Seymour Hersh here. Oh, yeah, you know, he might have broken the story of the My Lai Massacre, but one time he got this minor detail wrong about Jack Kennedy's affairs. Oh, yeah? Anything else we need to know about him? You just heard Flint Leverett just off the top of his head recite a tiny portion of the incredible journalism that and most important journalism that Seymour Hersh has done, especially over the last... well, I don't know. No, his whole career. But think about how good he was in the Bush years. All his stuff on the neocons, the Office of Special Plans, and how they lied us into war, and all the torture regime, and all their different war plans for Iran, and the truth about what they knew about Iran's nuclear program, and this, that, and every other thing, man. He was awesome. And, so, I'm not saying that means you have to trust everything he says or anything like that, but one time he got it wrong about what a mistress had said at a rally about JFK, something, whatever. Anyway, I thought that was worth pointing out that that's about the best they got. And then, let's see, I talked about that. And do I have time? I guess I do have time to talk about legalizing guns, don't I? Oh, no, I should talk about Ukraine, man. The legislature of, this is from globalsecurity.org. Oh, it's reprinting the Voice of Russia. It says the legislature of just proclaimed Donetsk, I should have asked the wife how to pronounce that, Donetsk Republic's, People's Republic, asked Putin to move in peacekeepers. So this is a city in eastern Ukraine. They're attempting to, they're going to hold a vote and attempt to declare independence and or secede from Ukraine and go and join Russia. This is a giant fist fight broke out in the parliament yesterday in Kiev. I'm not exactly certain what about. And here's America's threatening Russia. You better not instigate separatist tensions in eastern Ukraine. The Russians have said outright, we are not invading eastern Ukraine. We don't want to. We ain't going to. Now that does, and I actually take their word for it, if only because it looks ugly to lie that big. Not that it's really, you know, a deal breaker. Could be. But then again, America could still push them to it. And then here's what you need to know in a nutshell. Go read news.antiwar.com. They're giving them huge amounts of aid, and they're moving massive new amounts of material and money into NATO projects in Eastern Europe. In the name of Crimea. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org. Nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our next guest on the show today is Michael Ratner. He is President Emeritus, I think, at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome back to the show, Michael. How are you doing?
It's always great to be with you, Scott.
Good. Well, I'm very happy to have you back on the show. Not so happy to see this headline. McClatchy's version says, court rejects claims by family members of U.S. drone strike victims, which is surely true, but there's a lot more to it than that. Can you break the bad news to the people here?
Sure. We discovered really in 2010, I think, that the U.S. had put an American citizen and a cleric who was living in Yemen named Anwar el-Awlaki on its targeted kill list, either to be killed by drone or by Joint Special Operations Command in some other way. We went to court on his behalf saying you don't have a right to kill an American citizen outside a war zone when there's no imminent action contemplated, and you can't do that, it's illegal. And we went to court on behalf of Anwar's father, who was also living in Yemen, who was a Yemeni citizen. Unfortunately, the court in that case threw it out and said, the father cannot represent the son. You have to be in court for the son, which, of course, was almost impossible. It was impossible. And so we lost the case on what is technically called standing. 2 weeks later, or maybe not 2 weeks, but shortly after, Anwar El Awlaki, an American citizen, was killed in a drone strike in Yemen. Killed with him was another American citizen who was not on any kill list, a man named Samer Khan, who was a writer for a newspaper, I think it was called Inspire, a jihadist newspaper apparently in Yemen. They were both killed by drones. 2 weeks, literally 2 weeks after their kill, Anwar El Awlaki's son, Abdul Rahman, 16 years old, is also killed by a drone. The United States acknowledges they were not trying to kill Abdul Rahman El Awlaki. He was, quote, collateral damage, this beautiful 16-year-old boy. So at that point, you have three American citizens killed, one of them supposedly, one of them intentionally, Anwar El Awlaki, two being collateral damage, as they call it, Samer Khan and the young boy, Abdul Rahman El Awlaki. At that point, the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU together decide to go to court again. This time we're going to go to court for damages for the unlawful killing of all three American citizens. Our claims being that you can't kill an American citizen who's not imminently involved in combat outside a war zone, such as a war that's actually going on. This is in the middle of Yemen. It could have been in the middle of Montana or the United Kingdom. What gives the American president the right to simply murder someone with a drone? So we go to court for damages, and this time we're going in on behalf of the family of Samer Khan, as well as the grandfather of the 16-year-old, Nasser El Awlaki, as well as he's also the father of Anwar El Awlaki. And we go to court saying, you can't just do this. You need more than the president's authority. You have to go into a court. You have to get court authority and provide due process. And to do that, you have to meet certain standards, which is essentially the person has to have their finger on the button of a missile about to launch it to the United States, and there's no other feasible way to stop it, such as arresting the person, et cetera. And it has to be a specific and concrete threat, and it has to be imminent. And in this case, obviously, there was no court that did that, and the president deciding to murder someone is not due process of law, which everyone in the world, not just American citizens, are entitled to. So the decision you were reading the headline from came down a few days ago, and it said the court dismissed our lawsuit, saying that it's sufficient that the president ordered the murder, or the death, they called it, of Anwar El Awlaki, and that Samer Khan and Abdul Rahman were unfortunately killed. But they, of course, were not intentionally killed. They were killed as collateral damage, and you can't sue on their behalf either. So we lost the case in some incredibly awful reasoning. The court said, and this is a quote that no American, no person in the world should ever accept, that, quote, the defendants, in this case the defendants were the head of the CIA, the head of JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, various other military entities, that the defendants must be trusted and expected to act in accordance with the U.S. Constitution when they intentionally target a U.S. citizen abroad at the direction of the president and with the concurrence of Congress. So what the judge is saying there is the president orders the killing, then they have to be trusted. I mean, a more nasty, pernicious, and evil doctrine is hard to imagine, that if the president can order someone killed, that a court can't do anything about it. And I want to explain the thing about Congress. You said Congress also had given their concurrence. Well, that's not really the case here. What happened is Congress passed a law that may be familiar to your listeners. It's called the Authorization to Use Military Force. that was passed in the wake of 9/11, authorized essentially the bombing and the war with Afghanistan, as well as Guantanamo and everything else. It simply says the U.S. can go to war with the people who planned the 9/11 attacks. It's obviously been broadened so that it's almost anybody who the president wants. So Congress gave a broad authorization for a war, but it didn't give broad authorization that you can just kill Americans outside of a war zone. That's the first thing. And it never said anything about killing these three people. But even if it had, it seems to me to be a completely unauthorized and illegal doctrine that just because the president says and Congress says we can go kill American citizens, that doesn't mean a court doesn't have to step in there and say you can't do this, or you can if it meets certain very, very, very narrow circumstances. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we lost this case. And the quote, the key one, as I said, is the government must be trusted. And I want to look at it in the context of the role that's happened to the courts over the last 11 years. Let me finish one word on these three. Obviously, we can appeal the case to the Court of Appeals and then higher. But I must say, you know, if the courts have essentially taken a break from the U.S. Constitution since 9/11. We've lost, if you look at it, any cases to do with torture, every case to do with indefinite detention, and every case to do with drone killing, and rendition as well. So if you look at, you'd call it the four evils, or you can probably make up ten, but the courts have stepped aside when allegations of torture come in and haven't given relief to people who've been tortured, haven't given relief to the people still sitting in Guantanamo who are indefinitely detained, and haven't given relief even to American citizens who've been killed by drones. And, of course, we've lost every case on rendition as well. So you can basically say the courts are not just useless. They're worse than useless because they give many people in America the illusion that somehow we have a court system and we're getting rulings. But, in fact, they've upheld doctrines that before 9/11 you would have never suspected a court in the United States to uphold.
Mm. Well, you know, I got to admit, I'm a bit confused about, maybe there's an explanation in history where this comes from, that the judges say, well, if the president says it's a matter of national security, then it's none of my business. I remember Congress actually, some members of Congress sued Bill Clinton over violating the War Powers Act and starting the war with Kosovo, or they tried to, and the court said, no way, you two branches of government work this out among yourselves. It has nothing to do with us at all. And I just wonder, what's the precedent for that, where that comes from, where they're willing to apply that even as far as the assassination of American citizens, not just U.S. persons, but American citizens?
You know, that Kosovo case was a Center for Constitutional Rights case. I was a participant in that case. And in that case, they really didn't have the authority to do what they did. We claimed that, actually, in that case, that Congress didn't really give Clinton the authority, and certainly the United Nations haven't given the authority. And the court, as they have done in some 14 war cases that I've brought since my career began, beginning with Vietnam, going through Central America, the first Iraq war, the Kosovo war, that we have never actually won one of those cases in the courts. The closest we came was in the early El Salvador interventions, which took place shortly after Vietnam. Vietnam was over in 76. We started the El Salvador cases in 81, 82, and people still had enough memory of these unauthorized illegal wars that killed millions to say maybe we'll give a little restraint here. But really, since that time, it's been a zero, and the courts have allowed the president, really with or without Congress, to do whatever the president wants when it comes to war. And if you look at that, if you look at Libya, which happened just in the last year or so, 2 years, mm-hmm. The president in Libya, in the case of Libya, began bombing Libya and running the airplanes over Libya and the no-fly zones, et cetera, without the authority of Congress, which is completely unauthorized by the U.S. Constitution. Anytime U.S. forces go into action other than in strict self-defense when we're attacked, you have to get the authority of Congress. The president didn't do it in Libya, and he went ahead anyway. Would the court have done anything? The answer is 100% no. What they do is they give what they call the political branches, and by that they mean the elected branches, the Congress and the president, unlike the courts, which is not elected. They give the political branches broad authority to do pretty much what they want, despite the Constitution. In one way you could argue that the situation with the killing of an American citizen overseas, as was done in the Al-Awlaki cases, as well as Samar Khan, is actually an even more egregious violation of the Constitution than what was done in the Kosovo case. Although, obviously, in war cases, you're killing thousands or millions, so they're more egregious in many ways. But in a war case, it's generally true that Congress and the president together do have the right to make war under the U.S. Constitution.
All right, and with that, I'm sorry, we're going to have to stop right here just to go out to a very short commercial break. Michael, if you could hold on with us right there. We'll be right back,
sure,
y'all, with Michael Ratner. He's the president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Thank goodness for that. And we'll be right back after this. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, I'm back. It's the show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the line with Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He just finished losing a very important case in federal court. Appeals are still possible, though, as he said. So let me follow up on this point here, Michael. If this was not a matter of national security, but just say, for example, the police chief of Philadelphia announced that he was going to kill John Jackson. I'm going to kill that SOB. You watch me. And then John Jackson's father tried to file an injunction in the court to make him not do that. Would they just dismiss it because, I mean, they might follow through for other reasons, but would they have grounds, if they wanted to dismiss that because you're just his father, you're not him, and so you have no standing to sue? Because that seems to me pretty unfair, and I realize I've had 200 years to come up with all these loopholes where people don't have the right to really petition for redress, but come on.
I think they were wrong in that. I mean, obviously, if you can't get to your client for whatever reason, either because the client's in Yemen and you can't reach him, or he's in hiding somewhere in the United States, you should have a right to go to court as his close relative on his or her behalf to try and protect their constitutional rights. And that actually happened with us in the Guantanamo cases. They wouldn't tell us any of the people at Guantanamo, or they wouldn't let us get in touch with them. We got a hold of a couple of parents who we found out, and we actually had standing and were allowed to go to court on that. So I think in the drone case, the court was trying to avoid a hard decision on that case, and they shouldn't have refrained from it. Now, the other point that I think was implicit in your question, if a police chief says, I'm going to go kill John Jones because, you know, I think he's a danger to the community, you could go to court and stop the police chief. I mean, that's no issue here. I mean, unless John Jones, you know, was about to throw a bomb and you then shot him before he could throw the bomb at you, you know, that's a different case. But the case in which a police chief says, I'm going to go kill this guy because he's dangerous and he's plotting something, you can't do that. You have to try and arrest the guy.
Well, I mean, it was kind of a stupid hypothetical. What I was trying to get at was whether John Jackson Jr. or Senior, I mean, has the right to intervene, and or whether, you know,
no,
he
you
has
made
the
that
standing.
Point, but you're making another really good point, because I think in the case of the police chief, we could have stopped him. In the case of the president, we couldn't, and the situations are not that different. Why should the president be able to order the killing of an American citizen in Yemen versus the police chief ordered killing of an American in Philadelphia.
Well, because he pretends it's an international enemy and the rule of law doesn't apply to them, the laws of war do. Or
right.
some
it's
kind of made-up David Addington laws do.
Right, it's sort of your national security point. They use that as a sort of eraser to just erase our U.S. Constitution. They stick a big eraser to the Constitution. Doesn't apply to this Yemen guy. Goodbye. Even though he's an American citizen, even though he's not in a war zone, even though he went into a court and gave it the chance to actually stop the president, they refused. So we're living in essentially a very lawless, really lawless era. I mean, is you know, I've been a lawyer for 40 years, and this has been it's unprecedented what has occurred right now with these areas I've been talking about, from drone killings to indefinite detention to torture to rendition.
Mm-hmm. All right, now. I think there's been an admitted kind of within the government, there's been a dispute about whether they were targeting Alaki for, Jr., I mean, I'm sorry, Abdul Rahman, the grandson here, the 16-year-old. At first, they tried to claim that he was an adult, right?
No, he was the target,
but then they changed their mind and said that they were after someone else is what I'm trying to get at, if I'm right about that. They said that, well, no, we were trying to kill somebody else, and he just happened to be there, so we weren't targeting him, and so it doesn't matter. But they never really said who it was they were targeting instead or had a real excuse for why they were trying to kill his cousins either, right?
Yeah, I think that's correct, although in the opinion there is some mention of somebody else, but they were certainly silent for a long time. They wouldn't say a word. We kept trying to figure out what was going on because he was sitting at a table with four other people, you know, cousins and relatives or something, in an outdoor cafe, and it was pretty clear they weren't targeting any of them. That's become obvious. They were targeting somebody else, may have been nearby. The drone went off somewhere, maybe. Who knows? But they hit it so directly that they've never – the point that you're making, it's an important one, is we never have any transparency on who they're killing, what the rules are for their killing, why they do the killing. And this young kid is an American citizen. And, you know, I don't know if people have seen a film called Dirty Wars, a Jeremy Scahill film. They have incredibly beautiful footage of this young man, curly-haired, you know, in Yemen playing with his grandfather. And he goes off as a young man to try and find his father when he's 15 or 16 years old. He, of course, doesn't, is in the wrong area completely because his father's up north. He's somewhere in the south. And then they kill him. And you see this kid and you said, well, this could be my own kid. This is an outrage.
Yeah, well, now I'm not sure if I want to skip on to the spying, the NSA spying yet. I guess if you have anything left to say about this assassination thing, well, I guess I am curious still on if you could maybe help me refine what I get about what's considered collateral damage and what's not. Bush did this, a drone strike in Yemen back in 2002 where he killed an American citizen, but he swore he was targeting somebody else and it was just collateral damage. You mentioned how Alaki Sr., the father, not the grandfather, was on the list to be killed, but Samir Khan was not, but he was killed anyway. And I wonder, I guess, if the courts won't hear it, it doesn't make any difference. But, I mean, does it make any difference?
Well, it's a disgusting rule, and it tells you why even some of the rules of international law are so awful. Because here's what the rule is. The rule is two things. You have to be aiming at a military target. Of course, you could miss it, so then it's okay. You at least were aiming at the right place. And secondly, there has to be a proportionality in terms of who gets killed. So if I'm aiming for one bad guy, can I drop a bomb and kill 1,000 civilians who were sitting with him? In that case, it would be considered not proportional. You can't intend to kill one person and kill 1,000 others. In the case, this is the rule of law. I don't agree with it, but this is the rule. In the case of when you're trying to kill one bad guy, and another bad guy is killed with him, the laws of war would probably say you can do that. Now, the bigger question to me is why are the laws of war applying at all here? I mean, for two reasons. One, these people are not in a war zone. They're sitting in Yemen. The drone strike, a lot of the drone strike people, they're in Yemen, they're in Pakistan, they're in other countries, they're in the Horn of Africa. They're not to do with the war zone. So why are they applying the rules of war? Why aren't they applying the rules that we have when we have to, you know, arrest a bad guy? That's the first thing. The second thing is, I've always felt, even though I've been losing the fight, that people who try and commit acts of terrorism against the United States should be treated under criminal laws and not under the laws of war. That means you arrest them and you try them in regular federal criminal courts. You don't kill them or capture them and take them to Guantanamo. I'm sure I'm right about that legally, but that's another huge bend that happened in our law.
All right, now, can you give us a comment, too, Michael, about the Supreme Court's refusal to take up the claim and appeal?
The claim and appeal?
Oh, yeah, Larry Klayman had sued and had won on the lower court level on the Fourth Amendment against the NSA on the Verizon wiretapping and all that, right?
Oh,
the
many laws.
Judicial Watch?
This has been going on for years.
Yeah, now the Supreme Court has refused to hear the case.
Right. I mean, the Supreme Court, you know, has basically eviscerated the Fourth Amendment and the NSA. Not the NSA, they've eviscerated the Fourth Amendment and not giving any of us, you know, the right to go to court for all of this NSA stuff. You know, we lost another case the ACLU did last year in the NSA. It was close, but we lost. And, you know, the rules on the NSA, I mean, it's going to be a lot more litigation on it. But right now, we've been losing consistently on NSA cases in the courts.
I see now it says here, by the way, Michael, that he was using a rule where he could try to short-circuit the appeals process and go straight from regular federal court to the Supreme Court without stopping at the appeals courts in between.
Right.
So I guess maybe he'll have another shot at it.
Yeah, I guess so, but it's going to be, these cases have not been easy. It may be that in the current environment on the NSA, as we learn which ones of us have been surveilled, and there was an interesting story today, I think it was Snowden basically made a statement in an online interview that NGOs, such as Human Rights Watch, I think he mentioned,
right.
Or like Human Rights Watch.
Yeah, and Amnesty, too. He mentioned them both by name.
And Amnesty. Mm-hmm. Were being surveilled. That would include the Center for Constitutional Rights and all of us, which we suspected for a long time. And we actually brought a case like that in front of the courts, along with the ACLU and others, about our attorneys, about Guantanamo. And we got thrown out because we couldn't actually have a piece of paper that says we were surveilled. Now I think as we can get more exposure, perhaps from the Snowden documents, we'll be able to perhaps go back into courts on those. But, you know, this country has been, and Obama, one of the worst, just been terrible on this issue, terrible.
Yeah, well, and it sounds like the federal judiciary exists only as a rubber stamp, like in a country that the U.S. State Department would make fun of and criticize and threaten to bomb, probably.
The judiciary, as I pointed out, in these four areas has been a disaster. And then there, of course, is now a secret court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court, which has only one side, the government, and they've come out with all the rulings that have internally that have expanded the NSA's ability to take in, for example, this phone call that I'm having with you right now.
Right. Hey, by the way, what would be the best single ruling? Oh, and real quick, too, I'm sorry, we're almost out of time. What would be the best single ruling for proving what due process is supposed to mean, as opposed to the way Eric Holder says that if Obama mulls it over, that counts as due process? Is it really defined in the dictionary specifically?
There are court cases defining it, but generally, the court cases say you need a judicial process, not an executive process,
right,
to make due process. That's what due process means. You go
right
through a court process.
Thanks so much. We're all out of time. I appreciate your time so much, Michael. Appreciate it again. Thanks. Michael Ratner, everybody, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.